And our sermon text is Song of Solomon 4, verse 1, through Song of Solomon 5, verse 1. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, that graze among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hills of frankincense. Excuse me. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Seir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calmus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. Well, today you hold in your hands an artist's rendition of the beauty and comeliness of the Shulamite woman. Does it make you want a girl just like her? Or does it cause you to pause? I remember this drawing circulating on our seminary campus back in the early 80s. When some of our professors were cautioning us on a too overly literal interpretation of Scripture. And this was one of those examples. We had a good laugh and a lot of fun with it. Like I say, it's been in my files for decades, and I have been waiting for the moment when I can spring it on a congregation. And so here it is. But there was a serious point to be made. Poetry uses vivid metaphor to communicate. And Song of Solomon is some of the best poetry in Hebrew. Here it is beauty that is portrayed in our text today. And it's done in metaphors that any citizen of Israel would have understood intuitively, because he or she would have experienced these metaphors, if you will, daily in their lives. But it's a different story with us. Taken literally, they can come off somewhat more like the picture that you have in front of us, right? Look at those goats tumbling from the top of her head, huh? Well, let's explore these poetic images, shall we, today, to see what they tell us of our virtuous Shulamite woman. And equally important, Solomon's machinations and lavishing such praise upon her. Okay? There's a few points that I would like to make with you today, three from our text, divided into three sections. And that first is from verses 1 through 8. Verses 1 through 8. Solomon's first seduction. Solomon is on the warpath like the adulteress that we saw in Proverbs chapter 7. Only it's a him, Solomon, at work. Solomon's first seduction. In soaring rhetoric worthy of a great king, Solomon seeks to flatter the harem girls, specifically the Shulamite woman, verses 1 through 8. Now, as we established with you last week, Solomon has arrived in great pomp and circumstance. If you scan your eyes over the text previous and closing of chapter 3 there, you'll see that Solomon has arrived in great pomp and circumstance. We dealt with that from the desert, he did, right? With all the negative freight that that metaphor bears, that idea of a wilderness and a desert. In so many respects, his presence, his arrival, contrasts sharply with the search for and the discovery of the shepherd boy in the dream of the Shulamite girl. Summarizing a lot for you here. I would encourage you to access the previous sermons from this series to get yourself caught up maybe a little bit on the background. I hope we have those up in the near future so that you can access those and get a sense for how we're coming at this book. But I'll try to get you up to speed as best I can, too, as we work through the text. Solomon contrasts starkly with that shepherd boy, the true love of the Shulamite girl. Lavishly turned out as king he is, in contrast to this simple country shepherd boy. Solomon issues from the barren wilderness, the shepherd boy from the fertile countryside. Solomon brings his portable bedroom with him, right? Air Force One, we called it, right? The equivalent of Air Force One. The Shulamite and the shepherd boy retreat to the chamber of her mother, right? The chamber of her mother, a place of safety and protection. Solomon has decadent pleasure without fertility. Solomon has decadent pleasure without fertility. The Shulamite has fertility, right? She retreats to my mother's chamber, which is an allusion to her womb. There's a double entendre there, deliberate. My mother's chamber, that is not only the small place of retreat, but also an allusion to her mother's womb. Fertility. Without the pleasure, though, without the stolen pleasure, without pleasure yet, she has covenant obligations to fulfill first. And so, we've seen consistently Solomon represents the vanity of pleasure without covenant responsibility. Solomon does not come off well in this book. He represents the vanity of pleasure without covenant responsibility. The Shulamite girl represents the genuine pleasure of marriage when covenant responsibility is honored. For now, Solomon has landed in Air Force One, if you will, figuratively speaking, in a cloud of dust. And he's ready to sweep up any and all of the harem girls with one in particular focus for us, and that's the Shulamite girl. This speech is for her and for all and any of the harem girls. It is a kind of boilerplate speech which he has given before and which he will repeat again as often as he needs in order to persuade the harem girls to succumb to his charm. It is a form of flattery long employed by seducers of all kinds. We saw it today in our Old Testament lesson where the practiced adulteress flatters and cajoles naive young men into joining her on her bed. With much seductive speech, she persuades him, if you remember from our text. With her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or a stag is caught fast, right? And the end of it all is death. Or vanity, as Solomon called it. Remember from Ecclesiastes? Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Proverbs 31 woman, and the book of Ruth are all intimately bound together, connected. I've demonstrated that in past lessons. I encourage you to go back and listen to those to see how these are all consistent, all bound together, and all proclaim much the same message. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, I determined to test myself with pleasure and found in the end that all was vanity. This too, he says, is vanity. What we see opening up, transpiring all through the Song of Solomon, he determines in the end is vanity. A humble recognition, I submit to you, as Solomon was the writer of this book, a humble recognition indeed that his previous way of life was vanity. And the Shulamite girl, as my wife is fond of saying, she is the one who holds up, who stands. Those, her very name has the consonants of the name Solomon, only with the vowels that feminize it. Just as we have Alan and Alana sitting there with us today. Alana with Alan's name only feminized. So it is with the Shulamite girl, Solomon with feminized vowels. So she bears the brunt of wisdom in this book rather than Solomon. That's the irony of it all. Solomon represents the vanity of pleasure without covenant responsibility. And the Shulamite girl, the wise one, represents the genuine pleasure of marriage when covenant responsibility is on. I earned my way through college in part by serving as a banquet chef for the Pantland Hotel in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And we catered the high-end exclusive meals for not the silver salespeople at the top of Amway International. Anybody ever heard of Amway? Did you ever have an Amway salesman chase you down? Yeah, pretty obnoxious, right? But some of these people are very effective. And we served these high-end exclusive meals not for the gold salespeople either, but yay, the platinum sales representatives. At the very pinnacle of the Amway International Ponzi scheme. But I put my way through college on that money. And these were called shareholders. These were the millionaires that made billionaires of the creators of Amway, Rich Van Andel and Rich Voss. Every week of the year, several dozen of these shareholders were flown into Mecca, at his Amway International headquarters in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And they were wined and dined. They were shown around the facilities, and they were peppered with inspirational speeches and testimonies. The point was to wind them up even further and motivate them to sell even more. And on their last night, we served them a five-course filet mignon dinner, and the owners gave a stirring, inspirational speech that brought the house down every time. It was uncanny. It was the same speech. It was the same speech every week that had been honed and refined over the years for maximum effect. That's what Solomon's doing here. That speech flattered and cajoled and inspired these salespeople to even greater heights of motivation to sell, sell, sell. By the end of the speech, everyone was standing and clapping and whistling and cheering, and many were in tears too, except for us, the caterers. Right? We'd heard it all before. In fact, every Wednesday night for 2 years, we could give the speech. In fact, anywhere and at any time during our work week, one guy could cite the first part of a sentence and the other guy could finish it for him. But it was uncanny how well it worked. This is the sense of our text today. I hate to disillusion you on this. Solomon is on a mission to seduce the girls of the harem. It is in his own best interest to do so. It is a sales pitch, if you will, to prime and prepare naive, innocent virgins to give the best of their affections to the king for his own personal pleasure and enjoyment. I resolved to test myself with pleasure and found it too to be vanity, he says in Ecclesiastes, right? But, oh, pastor, you may say, how do you know that this is the sense of this section? It could just as easily be a speech given by either a sincere Solomon who is in love with a Shulamite girl, or even given by the shepherd boy, if you want to say he is there, right? And we have posited a shepherd boy as the true love of the Shulamite woman. Why can't it be one of those? Well, note with me several things. There's interpretive clues, and you have to have your biblical interpretive hat on when you're working with this book like none other, okay? Note with me these interpretive clues. Multiple partners and concubines outside of covenant marriage precludes Solomon's sincerity. Don't tell me that Solomon is sincerely in love with a Shulamite girl when he has 700 wives and 300 concubines. For centuries, the church, including Reformed interpreters, have tried to excuse Solomon here as having a true, sincere love for the Shulamite girl that is somehow different from his love for the other 699 wives and 300 concubines. In fact, so sincere is he that it serves as an allegory of Christ in the church, a common way, popular way of interpreting this book, as allegory. What? Though? What? How can this be when there are literally 999 other women he is servicing and with whom he is sharing affections? Does Christ have 999 other peoples he loves and has sacrificed on behalf of? Or just one church? Just one church, one bride for whom he has given all. One of the primary reasons evangelical preachers cannot preach Song of Solomon is because of the inherent contradictions within their model of allegorizing Solomon and the Shulamite girl as an allegory of Christ in the church. There's no getting around this. There's no getting around the glaring fact that in Song of Solomon, Solomon is a philandering womanizer who, with the ostensible exception of the Shulamite girl, gobbles up every lovely virgin in Israel for his harem. But we are expected to make a holy, sanctified exception here, so that we can construct a pious allegory of Christ in the church and do it in order to salvage some spiritual meaning from an otherwise carnal book. Right? That's some of the difficulties with the allegorizing model, or having Solomon without having the true love, the shepherd boy. You need not only the harem, but the shepherd boy to make sense of this book. So weak is this construction of Song of Solomon on its face that few, if any, Reformed or evangelical preachers have the effrontery to take it up and preach it, right? When have you heard this book preached? I never have. I'm 72 years old. I've never heard this book preached. And it is because they cannot do so without being embarrassed by playing exegetical twister, tying themselves in interpretive knots. Solomon cannot possibly be sincere here without contradicting the rest of Scripture. Secondly, other interpretive keys assure us that this is not the voice of the shepherd boy. If not for several factors, this could be the shepherd boy waxing eloquent about a Shulamite girl, right? Well, the first is that they have sex outside of the bonds of covenant marriage. That would bust the whole book, wouldn't it? Wide open. They do consummate, and we'll get to that eventually. They have sex outside of the bonds of covenant marriage. After describing her allurements, Solomon says, I came to my garden, my sister, my bride, and I gathered my myrrh with my spice. That is his consummation of the enticement, the seduction he has enticed the harem girls with. And it's only one of many places where Solomon or the shepherd boy have sex without the previous commitments of covenant marriage. I submit to you, it's Solomon. It is characteristic of harem life. And so we have this passage. But it's not characteristic of the Shulamite girl and the shepherd boy. Their relationship is always chaste and covenantal. And secondly, another interpretive clue that we have is that we have the Shulamite girl encounter her shepherd boy in dream sequences. In dream sequences. Now put your eyes on the text here. You remember back from chapter 3, verse 1, where she says, on my bed by night I sought him whom my soul loves, and then goes on a dream search then for her shepherd boy and finds him in a dream sequence, right? When does she encounter him again? Let your eyes go down to chapter 5, verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound. My beloved is knocking. Dream sequence 2. And we'll unpack that next week. So we have interpretive keys to posit the shepherd boy in contrast to Solomon. We know when our Shulamite girl encounters the shepherd boy. For now, it's in dreams until she is done with her probation in Solomon's harem. Only after she has endured the temptations of harem life will she be united with her true love, her shepherd boy of covenant marriage. Until then, her longing for physical intimacy must be fulfilled in dreams, a very important vehicle to communicate true covenant love, okay? And so, we see Solomon attempt to entice the harem girls and the Shulamite girl who is there with flattering language that is designed to seduce. She is extolled as beautiful. And he moves from head to toe in a flattering description of her. Doves are lovely, aren't they? We have them flying around our farm all the time. They're skittish and they're shy. Very attractive in a young girl. Not the brash boldness of the prostitute in chapter 7 of Proverbs that we encountered, right? And then he employs goats as a metaphor for beauty. And for the life of me, I can't understand why he employs goats. We have a goat farm, by the way. So I see goats up close. But actually, the image is really quite apt and graphic, too. If you've ever seen a flock of goats descend from any height, they do all kind of tumble down at once, sometimes gracefully, and with all the different coats, it can be a fun sight, too. They're so playful and quick on their feet. So as a metaphor for a woman's hair being undone, it is very poetic. And then one of the things that would be most striking to us, as we talk about her teeth, right? One of the things that would be most striking to us if we took a time machine back to this period would be how many people would be missing teeth. missing teeth in this day and time. We take it for granted. We take it for granted that modern dentistry either helps keep the teeth we have or replace them if they fall out. In Solomon's day, it was a rarity for anyone, even a beautiful country girl, to have all of her teeth and then have them glistening white and matching, like little white ewes coming up from the Jordan after bathing, right? We go for whitening treatments, but hers are naturally so. Be a true mark of beauty. And like my wife, Debbie, she wears very little makeup, the Shulamite girl, but yet her lips are red without having to daub them in lipstick. Pomegranates. Pomegranates are a tasty red fruit and an apt metaphor for rosy cheeks, right? And a long, graceful neck. I always think of Nefertiti, the statue of Nefertiti, Queen Nefertiti. A long, graceful neck was also a rare mark of a woman. Country girl, especially, you usually had a thicker, muscular neck from working on the farm. So, various features of her body are then quite graphically described, which we will tactfully leave to your imagination, except for one. Except for one. My history professor, Dr. John Woodbridge, in his lectures, was always fond of telling us that the very first thing we would notice, even before missing teeth, if we could be transported back to ancient days, the very first thing we would notice and be shockingly repulsed by if we suddenly stepped into an ancient village or city would be the smell. Very few people bathed or showered for weeks or months or seasons even, right? Like the mountain men. And the combined stench to which the ancient man acclimated would bowl us over. But not our harem girls. Their bodies from head to toe bore the fragrance of myrrh and frankincense. Okay? And her beauty is summarized by being altogether so. There is no flaw in you, he says. And then he bids her to permanently remove from her home in the furthest reaches of the land, that is Mount Hermon, for example. Centrally located in Israel, it was high, snow-capped year-round. And like Sinir or Amana, these two mountains were in the anti-Lebanon range, faced north. They were remote and stunningly beautiful places, but probably the farthest, wildest territory from the ease and the comfort and the safety of the harem. And so the implicit threat of lions and leopards are there too. She will be safe in the harem. In good old bustling Jerusalem and the palace. Trade all this for palace life. Come, join the harem. Seduction. So, after a speech calculated to flatter any harem girl, the target is the Shulamite woman, Solomon now proceeds to arouse love before its time. Point two. Remember, we've seen two times now when the Shulamite girl adjures, that is, makes to swear the harem girls that they will not awaken, they will not arouse love. All the side benefits of love, right, the sex and the intimacy, all of it false and empty, don't arouse that until it is ready. But that's precisely what Solomon is doing. He now proceeds to arouse love before its time. Point two, verses 9 through 16a. Solomon's first seduction. You think there'll be more? More attempts? It's his first seduction, right? Implicit is at least one more. Solomon's first seduction. In soaring rhetoric worthy of a great king, Solomon seeks to swoon the harem girls, specifically the Shulamite woman. These verses, verses 9 through 16a, these verses are words of sexual arousal, plain and simple. The sight, with the glance of your eyes, the sounds, the winds that blow, which is an allusion to the sighs and moans of lovemaking, the smells, the fragrance of your oils, and those are bodily oils, the tastes, your lips drip nectar, honey and milk are under your tongue, allusions to kissing, and the feelings that are brought on by love being awakened, which she has already adjured the harem girls and Solomon implicitly not to do. The feelings that are brought on by love being awakened. You've captivated my heart, my sister, which is a term of affection, like a pet name, or my bride, even in the harem, bride used as a pet name. These are all recited in order to arouse the harem girls and the Shulamite girl in particular in preparation for and anticipation of making love to the king. The accomplished poet, a true son of his father David, has honed and refined this part of his speech too, in order to maximize the pleasure both he and they will experience. These harem girls were all virgins. See verse 12. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed, the idea of virginity. And as virgins, they needed to be coaxed and encouraged to respond to the king's blandishments. So, cumulative here now, as we're working our way through this chapter and the previous one, hopefully after being stunned and bowled over by his grand entrance, then flattered by the eloquent compliments as he looks her over, the Shulamite or the harem girl will now swoon at the lyrics of this poem, like the young teen girls at an Elvis concert, or the girls at the height of the Beatlemania. Today, it's difficult to capture the sense of electricity and excitement aroused by rock stars like Elvis or the Beatles. You gray hairs may remember, right? You gray hairs may remember. Perhaps you boomer women were some of those teen adolescents swooning and fainting in the audience of the Ed Sullivan Show. Debbie remembers how her mother wept like a baby when she heard that Elvis had died. Yeah. Now, sociologists and psychologists have long pontificated on how and why the rock and roll phenomenon unleashed all of these teen passions and this giddy swooning, right? The girls wanted to be near men like Elvis, and teen boys wanted to be like Elvis in order to get the teen girls. Now, most of these experts agree that it was in part an explosion of repressed feeling from the stifling, oppressive morality of the 40s and 50s. At least that's what the experts say. Rock and roll gave girls permission to feel and express their sexual passions, and the handsome boy from Tupelo, Mississippi, as Solomon says, blew upon their garden, making their spices flow with his rhythmic, arousing music. Both he and the Beatles stirred up and awakened love before it pleased, if you will, which is exactly what the Shulamite girl is adjuring and saying, don't do this. Well, Elvis sure did, didn't he? So did the Beatles. They stirred up and awakened love before it pleased. That is, they indulged, they harvested all the fruit of covenant love, that is sex, and a false sense of intimacy and personal relationship, right? They aroused all that and harvested all those fruits of covenant love without any of the covenant preparation or commitment or signs and seals of covenant love. So we say, Solomon was the Elvis of Israel. Can I put it that way? Solomon was the Elvis of Israel. He was the rock star of his day, who stirred up and awakened love before it pleased. And he did it on a regular basis. With every new virgin from the harem, he deflowered for his own pleasure. Which girl was then consigned to the harem, never to be seen again, unless Solomon remembered her and wished to enjoy her some more. That's one of the driving mechanisms in the plot of Esther, isn't it? One of the driving mechanisms in the whole plot of Esther. Will Esther be recalled to Ahasuerus' bedroom, where she can indeed then tell him about the plot against Israel? One of the driving mechanisms is, will he see her again? Will he remember her? Well, most of them were not remembered. But the trade-off for the harem girl, the trade-off, and this has already been shown to us, demonstrated to us, the trade-off was that although she would likely never experience the God-giving blessings of covenant marriage, the newly minted concubine, after her first night with Solomon, would nevertheless live a life of luxury and ease in the harem for the rest of her life with the best of everything. That's something, isn't it? Or is it? Or is it? Really, huh? That brings us to point three. Solomon's first seduction. In soaring rhetoric, worthy of a great king, Solomon seeks to consummate with the harem girls, specifically the Shulamite woman. Specifically the Shulamite woman. The idea of consummating now this relationship, after beckoning them, after seducing them, right? Now, the grammar for this section indicates that she, there's a feminine singular there, speaks and gives permission for Solomon to awaken love before it is covenantally complete, that is, before it pleased. And he, the masculine singular there, does precisely that, gracefully expressed as if dining on a rich repast from the garden and table of a king. She's likened to a garden, the intimate partner, a sister, a bride, pet names, love names. The fragrances are sweet, the lovemaking like honey, wine, and milk. And then the seal of approval is stamped upon it all by the surrounding harem, third person plural there. Others, your ESV says. Once again, those headings are not in the original, okay? So just, if you can erase it, just erase those headings because they're inaccurate. They oftentimes mislead. Others. What? Others? No. This is the surrounding harem. These are the harem girls putting their stamp of approval on it all. It's important to put them in the context. Context of the harem. It's the only one which makes sense of the song. And the context is also one of excess, which is probably why this is not the Shulamite girl with whom he's consummating this relationship. Eat, drink, and be merry. Be drunk with love. That was the pursuit of Solomon. I resolved to test myself with pleasure, but found in the end that it too was vanity. This is the context of this text. But does our Shulamite girl really succumb to the hysteria surrounding the rock show that is the harem of the Elvis of Israel? Does she succumb? Well, we'll see next week. We'll see you next week. So as we come to this text and the whole book for that matter, it's important not to fall into one of two ditches on either side of us on our trail in the Song of Solomon. First of all, don't despair at the cynical use to which Solomon puts the daughters of Jerusalem. Don't despair about this. Now, we've been in this for the last 2 weeks, so don't despair. Solomon does not come off well in the Song of Solomon, does he? If our construction of the song is correct, then some of the cherished love songs and perspectives and characters of the book have just been plain wrong. And you have to readjust your attitudes and your approaches to them. You can still use this song. It's a beautiful song, isn't it? A flattering song, a love song. You can still use this with your wife, guys, right? But just understand where it occurs here in the context of the Song of Solomon. Our perspective does have the advantage of seeing the world more realistically and contextually. Men have always been like Solomon. The rock and roll seduction has always been practiced and perfected by pleasure seekers like Solomon. And the love song we have just seen sung does have a place. Does have its place in the marriage bed when covenantally signed and sealed. When bound between one man and one woman in a biblical love that is, as Van Pelt puts it, rock solid and white hot. And that's derived from chapter 8. When we get through all of the temptations and the Shulamite girl gets through her probation in the harem, she will reflect very wisely in chapter 8 on what true love is. Our heroine, the Shulamite, wiser than Solomon, will triumph in the end. She will remain loyal to the covenant model the Bible has always held out. So, don't despair. That's ditch number one you can fall into. Ditch number two, don't attempt to escape all of these issues by means of allegory. The old way of interpreting for so long, and the church has fallen into a ditch because of their means of allegorizing this book. So many interpreters through the centuries, as you review the history of the interpretation of this book, so many interpreters through the centuries have been uncomfortable with and reluctant to deal with the delicate, graphic nature of the sexual imagery in Song of Solomon. It ain't easy. Remember when Brian in Sunday school the other week said, how many of you were a little uncomfortable when you heard Pastor was going to preach Song of Solomon? And I was the first one to raise my hand. Delicate, graphic nature of the sexual imagery in the Song of Solomon. And so these interpreters from history, they'll say things like, it's really not talking about sex, love, and marriage. It's really talking about Christ in the church, right? That's an interpretive cop-out. While it is good and right to seek Christ in the song, and he's there, it is of no spiritual benefit to create a phantom Christ in the text where no substance exists. Christ is just not there by the allegorical means that so many interpreters labor so mightily to put on him. The Song of Solomon gives no indication that it intends to be taken as an allegory. Well then, Mr. Smarty Pants Preacher, just where is Christ in all of this? I'm fond of saying, I say it all through our membership course, that Christ is in all the scripture from Genesis to Revelation. Where is he in the song then? Right? Where is he in the song? And once more, it must be reiterated from the rooftops that the biblical covenant model being faithfully clung to by our heroine, Shulamite, is the very same Paul's mystery of Christ and the church, the very same. All the progressive revelation is moving towards that truth and reality of Christ and his church, which marriage models. Christ and his church. One man, one woman, one Savior, one people. By being faithful to that model and to the one man, one woman model, by being faithful to her shepherd boy, Shulamite is being faithful to Christ. Conversely, by having many women, Solomon is being faithless to that covenant. Solomon knew better and repented of it later by writing, in part by writing this book. Because Israel already had a model of the one man, one woman relationship created in the garden. We go all the way back to the garden, and we go all the way to Revelation. He already had a model of that one man, one woman relationship created in the garden with Adam and Eve. He had Yahweh and Israel, which was a type of Christ and the church. Shulamite's faithfulness to her shepherd boy models the church's faithfulness to Christ. The believers in Thyatira, we read from our New Testament lesson today, the believers in Thyatira wrestled with the very same issues. Some of whom were being taught, as our Lord says to John, some of whom were being taught and seduced by that prophetess Jezebel to do what? To practice sexual immorality and idolatry. What happened to Solomon, right? Horses and women were his failures, weren't they? I counseled men in Chicago when I ministered there. Went out to the racetrack and bet all their money and slept with prostitutes. Horses and women. Solomon's downfall. The very same temptations that he dangles before the Shulamite, right? Will she remain faithful? I think you already know what the answer is going to be. But she indeed is faithful to Christ and serves as a model for us, for the church as well. Well, let us now come to that place where we see the bride and the bridegroom, Christ and his church together in the simple drama of our table, the body and blood, and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.